Chapter 31. "Why, Wolf?" Falca asked. They were meeting alone on the same iron-gray, silver-skied expanse of rock pools where she had, at Skade's insistence, already encountered the wolf. Now she was dreaming lucidly. She was back on Clavain's ship, and Skade was dead, and yet the wolf seemed no less real than it had before. The wolf's shape lingered just beyond clarity, like a column of smoke that occasionally fell into a mocking approximation of human form.
"Why what?
Why do you hate life so much?"
"I don't. We don't. We only do what we must."
Falca kneeled on the rock, surrounded by animal parts. She understood that the presence of the wolves explained one of the great cosmic mysteries, a paradox that had haunted human minds since the dawn of spaceflight. The galaxy teemed with stars, and around many of those stars were worlds. It was true that not all of those worlds were the right distance from their suns to kindle life, and not all had the right fractions of metals to allow complex carbon chemistry. Sometimes the stars were not stable enough for life to gain a toehold, but none of that mattered, since there were hundreds of billions of stars. Only a tiny fraction had to be habitable for there to be a shocking abundance of life in the galaxy. But there was no evidence that intelligent life had ever spread from star to star, despite the fact that it was relatively easy to do. Looking out into the night sky, human philosophers had concluded that intelligent life must be vanishingly rare, that perhaps the human species was the only sentient culture in the galaxy. They were wrong, but they did not discover this until the dawn of interstellar society. Then expeditions started finding evidence of fallen cultures, ruined worlds, extinct species. There were an uncomfortably large number of them. It was not that intelligent life was rare, it seemed, but that intelligent life was very, very prone to becoming extinct, almost as if something was deliberately wiping it out. The wolves were the missing element in the puzzle, the agency responsible for the extinctions. Implacable, infinitely patient machines, they homed in on the signs of intelligence and enacted a terrible, crushing penalty. Hence, a lonely, silent galaxy, patrolled only by watchful machine sentries. That was the answer, but it did not explain why they did it.
"But why?" she asked the wolf. "It doesn't make any sense to act the way you do. If you hate life so much, why not end it once and for all?"
"For good?"
The wolf appeared amused, curious about her speculations.
"You could poison every world in the galaxy, or smash every world apart. It's as if you don't have the courage to finally finish life for good."
There was a slow avalanche-like sigh of pebbles.
"It isn't about ending intelligent life," the wolf said.
"No?"
"It is about the exact opposite, Falca. It is about life's preservation. We are life's keepers, steering life through its greatest crisis."
"But you murder, you kill entire cultures."
The wolf shifted in and out of vision. Its voice, when it answered, was tauntingly similar to Galliana's.
"Sometimes you have to be cruel to be kind, Falca."
No one saw much of Clavain after Galliana's death. There was an unspoken understanding amongst his crew, one that percolated right down through to the lowliest ranks of Scorpio's army, that he was not to be disturbed by anything except the gravest of problems, matters of extreme shipwide urgency, nothing less. It remained unclear whether this edict had come from Clavain himself, or was simply something that had been assumed by his immediate deputies. Very probably it was a combination of the two. He became a shadowy figure, occasionally seen but seldom heard, a ghost stalking zodiacal lights corridors in the hours when the rest of the ship was asleep. Occasionally, when the ship was under high gravity, they heard the rhythmic thump, thump, thump of his exoskeleton on the deck plates as he traversed a corridor above them. But Clavain himself was an elusive figure. It was said that he spent long hours in the observation cupola, staring into the blackness behind them, transfixed by the starless wake. Those who saw him remarked that he looked much older than at the start of the voyage, as if in some way he remained anchored to the faster flow of world time, rather than the dilated time that passed aboard the ship.
It was said that he looked like a man who had given up on the living, and was now only going through the burdensome motions of completing some final duty. It was recognized, without the details necessarily being understood, that Clavaine had been forced into making a dreadful personal decision. Some of the crew members grasped that Galliana had already died long before, and that what had happened now was only the drawing of a line beneath that event. But it was, as others appreciated, much worse than that. Galliana's earlier death had only ever been provisional. The conjoiners had kept her frozen, thinking that she could at some point be cleansed of the wolf. The likelihood of that happening must have been small, but at the back of Clavaine's mind there must have remained the ghost of a hope that the Galliana he had loved since that ancient meeting on Mars could be brought back to him, healed and renewed. But now he had personally removed that possibility forever. It was said that a large factor in his decision had been Felka's persuasion, but it was still Clavaine who had made the final choice. It was he who carried the blood of that merciful execution on his hands. Clavaine's withdrawal was less serious to ship affairs than it might have appeared. He had already abrogated much of the responsibility to others, so that the battle preparations continued smoothly and efficiently without his day-to-day intervention. Mechanical production lines were now running at full capacity, spewing out weapons and armor. Zodiacal Light's hull bristled with anti-ship armaments. As training regimes honed the battalions of Scorpio's army into savagely efficient units, they began to realize how much their previous successes had been down to good fortune, but that would certainly not be the case in the future. They might fail, but it would not be because of any lack of tactical preparation or discipline. With Skade's ship destroyed, they had less need to worry about an attack while they were en route. Deep-look scans confirmed that there were other conjoiner ships behind them, but they could only match Zodiacal Light's acceleration, not exceed it. It appeared that no one was willing to attempt another State 4 transition after what had happened to Nightshade. Halfway to Resurgam, the ship had switched into deceleration mode, thrusting in the direction of flight, which immediately made it a harder target for the pursuing craft, since they no longer had a relativistically boosted exhaust beam to lock onto. The risk of attack had dropped even further, leaving the crew free to concentrate on the mission's primary objective. Data from the approaching system became steadily more comprehensive too, focusing minds on the specifics of the recovery operation. It was clear that something very odd was happening around Delta Pavonis. Scans of the planetary system showed the inexplicable emission of three moderately large terrestrial bodies, as if they had simply been deleted from existence. More worrying still was what had replaced the system's major gas giant. Only a remnant of the giant's metallic core now remained, enveloped in a skein of liberated matter many dozens of times wider than the original planet. There were hints of an immense mechanism that had been used to spin the planet apart, arcs and cusps and coils that were in the process of being dismantled and retransformed into new machinery. And at the heart of the cloud was something even larger than those subsidiary components, a 2,000-kilometer-wide engine that could not possibly be of human origin. Remontoir had helped Clavaine build sensors to pick up the neutrino signatures of the Hell-class weapons. As they had neared the system, they had established that 33 of the weapons were in essentially the same place, while 6 more were dormant, waiting in a wide orbit around the neutron star Hades. One weapon was unaccounted for, but Clavaine had known about that before he left the Mother Nest. More detailed scans, which became possible only when they had slowed to within a quarter of a light year of their destination, showed that the 33 weapons were almost certainly aboard a ship of the same basic type as Zodiacal Light, probably stuffed into a major storage bay. The ship, it had to be the Triumvir's vessel, Nostalgia for Infinity, hovered in interplanetary space, orbiting Delta Pavonis at the Lagrange point between the star and Resurgam. Now, finally, they had some measure of their adversary. But what of Resurgam itself? There was no radio or other EM-band traffic coming from the system's sole inhabited planet, but the colony had clearly not failed. Analysis of the atmosphere's constituent gases revealed ongoing terraforming activity, with sizable expanses of water now visible on the surface. The ice caps had withered back towards the poles. The air was warmer and wetter than it had been in nearly a million years. The infrared signatures of surface flora matched the patterns expected from Terran gene stock, modified for cold, dry, low-oxygen survivability. Hot thermal blotches showed the sites of large brute-force atmospheric reprocessors. Refined metals indicated intense surface industrialization. At extreme magnification, there were even the suggestions of roads or pipelines, and the occasional moving echo of a fat, trans-atmospheric cargo vehicle, like a dirigible. The planet was certainly inhabited, even now, but whoever was down there was not much interested in communicating with the outside world. "It doesn't matter," Scorpio told Clavain. "You came here to take the weapons, that's all. There's no need to make this any more complicated than it has to be." Clavain had been alone until the pig had visited him. "Just deal with the starship." "Is that it? We can start negotiations immediately if we transmit a beta-level proxy. They can have the weapons ready for us when we arrive. Nice quick turnaround and we're away. The other ships won't even have reached the system."
"Nothing's ever that easy, Scorp."
Clavain spoke with morose resignation, his eyes focused on the starfield beyond the window.
"You don't think negotiations will work? Fine. We'll skip it and just come in with all guns blazing.
In which case, we'd better hope they don't know how to use the Hell-class weapons, because if it comes to a straight fight, we won't have a snowball's chance."
"I thought that Volyova turning the weapons against us wasn't going to be a problem."
Clavain turned from the window. "Remontoir can't promise me that our pacification codes will work. And if we test them too soon, we give Volyova time to find a workaround. If such a thing exists, I'm pretty sure she'll find it."
"Then we keep trying negotiation," Scorpio said. "Send the proxy, Clavain. It will buy us time and cost us nothing."
The man did not answer him directly.
"Do you think they understand what's happening to their system, Scorpio?"
Scorpio blinked. Sometimes he had difficulty following the swerves and evasions of Clavain's moods. The man was far more ambivalent and complex than any human he had known since his time aboard the yacht.
"Understand that the machines are already there, already busy. If they look into the sky, surely they can't miss what is happening. Surely they must realize that it isn't good news."
"What else can they do, Clavain? You've read the intelligence summaries. They probably don't have a single shuttle down there. What can they do but pretend it isn't happening?"
"I don't know," Clavain said.
"Let us transmit the proxy," Scorpio said. "Just to the ship, tight beam only."
Clavain said nothing for at least a minute. He had turned his attention back to the window, staring out into space. Scorpio wondered what he hoped to see out there. Did he imagine that he could unmake that glint of light, the one that had signaled Galliana's end, if he tried hard enough? He had not known Clavain as long as some of the others, but he viewed Clavain as a rational man. But he supposed grief, the kind of howling, remorse-filled grief Clavain was experiencing, could smash rationality to shards. The impact of so familiar an emotion as sadness on the flow of history had never been properly accounted for, Scorpio thought. Grief and remorse, loss and pain, sadness and sorrow were at least as powerful shapers of events as anger, greed, and retribution.
"Clavain?"
he prompted. "I never thought there'd be choices this hard," the man said. "But H was right. The hard choices are the only ones that matter. I thought defecting was the hardest thing I had ever done. I thought I would never see Felka again. But I didn't realize how wrong I was, how trivial that decision was. It was nothing compared with what I had to do later. I killed Galliana, Scorpio. And the worst thing is that I did it willingly."
"But you got Felka back again. There are always consolations."
"Yes,"
Clavain said, sounding like a man grasping for the last crumb of comfort.
"I got Felka back. Or at least I got someone back. But she isn't the way I left her. She carries the wolf herself now, just a shadow of it, it's true. But when I speak to her, I can't be sure whether it's Felka answering or the wolf. No matter what happens now, I don't think I'll ever be able to take anything she says at face value."
"You cared for her enough to risk your life rescuing her. That was a difficult choice as well, but it doesn't make you unique."
Scorpio scratched at the upraised snout of his nose.
We've all made difficult choices around here. Look at Antoinette. I know her story, Clavain. Set out to do a good deed, burying her father the way he wanted, and she ends up entangled in a battle for the entire future of the species. Pigs, humans, everything. I bet she didn't have that in mind when she set out to salve her conscience. But we can't guess where things will take us, or the harder questions that will follow on from one choice. You thought defecting would be an act in and of itself, but it was just the start of something much larger.
Clavain sighed. Perhaps it was his imagination, but Scorpio thought that he detected the slightest lightening of the man's mood. His voice was softer when he spoke.
What about you, Scorpio? Did you have choices to make as well?
Yeah. Whether I threw my weight in with you human sons of bitches.
And the consequences? Some of you are still sons of bitches that deserve to die in the most painful and slow way I can envisage. But not all of you. I'll take that as a compliment. Take it while you can. I might change my mind tomorrow.
Clavain sighed again, scratched his beard, and then said,
All right. Do it. Transmit a beta-level proxy. We'll need a statement to accompany it, Scorpio said. A laying down of terms, if you like. Whatever it takes, Scorp. Whatever the hell it takes.
In their long, crushing reign, the inhibitors had learned of 15 distinct ways to murder a dwarf star. Doubtless, the Overseer thought to itself, there were other methods, more or less efficient, which might turn out to have been invented or used at various epochs in galactic history. The galaxy was very large, very old, and the inhibitors' knowledge of it was far from comprehensive, but it was a fact that no new technique for Starside had been added to their repository for 440 million years. The galaxy had finished two rotations since that last methodological update. Even by the inhibitors' glacial reckoning, it was quite a worryingly long time during which not to learn any new tricks. Singing a star apart was the most recent method to be entered into the inhibitor library of Xenocide techniques, and though it had achieved that status 440 million years earlier, the Overseer could not help view it with a trace of bemused curiosity. It was the way an aged butcher might view some newfangled apparatus designed to improve the productivity of an abattoir. The current cleansing operation would provide a useful testbed for the technique, a chance to fully evaluate it. If the Overseer was not satisfied, it would leave a record in the archive recommending that future cleansing operations employ one of the 14 older methods of Starside. But for now, it would place its faith in the efficacy of the singer. All stars already sang to themselves. The outer layers of every star rang constantly at a multitude of frequencies, like an eternally chiming bell. The great seismic modes tracked oscillations that plunged deep into the star, down to the caustic surface just above its fusing core. Those oscillations were modest in a star of dwarf type, like Delta Pavonis. But the singer tuned itself to them, swinging around the star in its equatorial rotation frame, pumping gravitational energy into the star at precisely the right resonant frequencies to enhance the oscillations. The singer was what the mammals would have called a graver, a gravitational laser. In the heart of the singer, a microscopic closed cosmic string, a tiny relic of the rapidly cooling early universe, had been tugging out of the seething foam of the quantum vacuum. The string was barely a scratch compared with the largest cosmic flaws, but it would suffice for the singer's purposes. It was tugged and elongated like a loop of toffee, inflated with the same vacuum phase energy that the singer tapped for all its needs, until it had macroscopic size and macroscopic mass-energy density. Then the string was deftly knotted into a figure-of-eight configuration and plucked, generating a narrow cone of throbbing gravitational waves. The oscillations increased in amplitude, slowly but surely. At the same time, chirping gravitational pulses with precision and elegance, the singer sculpted the patterns themselves, causing new vibrational modes to spring into play, enhancing some and suppressing others. The star's rotation had already destroyed any spherical symmetry in the original oscillation modes, but the modes had still been symmetric with respect to the star's axis of spin.
Yet now the singer worked to instill more profoundly asymmetric modes in the star, focusing its efforts on a single equatorial point immediately between the singer and the star's center of mass. It increased its power and focus, the closed cosmic string oscillating even more vigorously. Immediately below the singer, on the outer envelope of the star, mass flows were pinched and reflected, heating and compressing surface hydrogen to near fusion conditions. Fusion did indeed erupt in 3 or 4 concentric rings of stellar matter, but that was incidental. What mattered, what the singer intended, was that the star's spherical envelope should begin to pucker and distort. Something like a navel was appearing in the star's seething hot surface, an inward dimple wide enough to swallow a whole rocky world. Concentric rings of fusion, circles of searing brightness, spread out from the dimple, squalling X-rays and neutrinos into space. Still, the singer continued pulsing the star with gravitational energy, the timing surgically acute, and still the dimple sank deeper, as if an invisible finger were pushing against the pliant skin of a balloon. Around the dimple, the star was bulging higher into space as matter was redistributed. The matter had to go somewhere, for the singer was excavating a hole deep into the star's interior. It would continue until it had reached the star's nuclear burning core. It was a 15-hour trip from Resurgam orbit to Nostalgia for Infinity, and Curry spent every minute of it in a state of extreme apprehension. It was not simply the strange and worrying thing that had started to happen to Delta Pavonis, although that was certainly a significant part of it. She had seen the inhibitor weapon start its work, pointing like a great flared bugle at the surface of the star, and she had seen the star respond by growing a furious hot eye on its surface. Magnification showed the eye to be a zone of fusion, several zones, in fact, which surrounded a deepening pit in the star's envelope. It was in the face of the star that was turned towards Resurgam, which did not seem likely to be accidental. And whatever the weapon was doing it with astonishing speed. The weapon had taken so long to reach readiness that Curry had mistakenly assumed that the final destruction of Delta Pavonis would take place on the same leisurely timescale. This was clearly not going to be the case. She would have been better thinking of an elaborate build-up to an execution, with many legal hurdles and delays, but which would conclude in a single bullet shot or killing surge of electrical current. That was how it was going to be with the star, a long, grave preparation followed by an extremely swift execution. And they had still evacuated only 2,000 people. In fact, it was far worse. They had transported 2,000 people from the surface of Resurgam, but none of those had yet seen Nostalgia for Infinity, or had any idea of what they were going to find when they stepped aboard it. Curry hoped that none of her nervousness was apparent, since the passengers were volatile enough already. It was not simply the fact that the transfer craft was designed to take far fewer occupants, and so they were forced to endure the journey in cramped, prison-like conditions, with the environmental system strained to the limit just to provide sufficient air, water, and refrigeration. These people were taking a tremendous risk, putting their faith in forces utterly beyond their control. The only thing holding them together was Thorn, and even Thorn appeared on the edge of nervous exhaustion. There were constant squabbles and minor crises breaking out all over the ship, and whenever they happened, Thorn was there, soothing and reassuring, only to dash off somewhere else as soon as the trouble had been allayed. His charisma was being stretched butter thin. He had not only been awake for the entire trip, but also for the day before the liftoff of the final shuttle flight and the 6 hours it had taken to find places for the 500 new arrivals. It was taking too long. Curry could see that. There would have to be another 99 flights like this before the evacuation operation was done, 99 further opportunities for all hell to break loose. It might get easier once word got back to Resurgam that there was a starship at the end of the journey, rather than some diabolical government trap. On the other hand, when the precise nature of the starship became clearer, things might get an awful lot worse. And there was every likelihood that the weapon would soon finish whatever it had initiated around Delta Pavonis. When that happened, every other problem would suddenly look very slight indeed. But at least they were nearly home and dry with this trip. The transfer ship was not designed for transatmospheric flight. She was a graceless sphere, with a cluster of motors at one pole and the dimple of a flight deck at the other. The first 500 passengers had spent many days aboard, exploring every grubby cranny of her austere interior, but at least they had had some room to spare. When the next load came up, things became a little more difficult. Food and water had to be rationed, and each passenger assigned a specific cubbyhole, but it was still tolerable. Children had still been able to run around and make nuisances of themselves, and adults had still been able to find a little privacy when they needed it. Then the next shipment had come up, another 500, and the whole tone of the ship had changed subtly, and for the worse. Rules had to be enforced rather than politely suggested. Something very close to a miniature police state had been created aboard the ship, with a harsh scale of penalties for various crimes. So far there had been only minor infringements of the draconian new laws, but Kuri doubted that every trip would run as smoothly. Sooner or later she would probably be required to make an example of someone, for the benefit of the others. The final 500 had been the greatest headache. Slotting them in had resembled a fiendish puzzle. No matter how many permutations they tried, there were always 50 people still waiting on the shuttle, glumly aware that they had been reduced to irksome surplus units in a problem that would have been a great deal more tractable had they not existed. And yet, finally, a way had been found to get everyone aboard. That part at least would be simpler next time, but the rule of discipline might have to be even stricter. The people could be allowed no rights aboard the transfer craft. 13 hours out, a kind of exhausted calm fell across the ship. She met Thorn by a porthole, just out of earshot of the nearest huddle of passengers. Ashen light made his face statue-like. He looked utterly dejected, sapped of any joy in what they had achieved. "We've done it," she said. "No matter what happens now, we've saved 2,000 lives." "Have we?" he asked, keeping his voice low. "They're not going back to Resurgam, Thorn." They spoke like business associates, avoiding physical contact. Thorn was still a guest of the government, and there must not appear to be any ulterior motive behind his cooperation. Because of that necessary distance, an act that had to be maintained at all times aboard the shuttle, she felt the urge to sleep with him more strongly than she had ever done before. She knew that they had come very close aboard the ship after the encounter with the inhibitor cubes in Rock's atmosphere, but they had not done it then, and nor had they when they were on Resurgam. The erotic tension that had existed between them ever since had been thrilling and painful at the same time. Her attraction to him had never been stronger, and she knew that he wanted her at least as much. It would happen, she knew. It was just a question of accepting what she had long known she had to accept, which was that one life was over and another must begin. It was about making the choice to discard her past and accepting, forcing herself to believe, that she was not dishonoring her husband by that act of disavowal. She just hoped that, wherever he was, alive or dead now, Fazil Kuri had come to the same realization and had found the strength to close the chapter on the part of his life that had included Anna Kuri. They had been in love, desperately in love, but the universe cared nothing for the vicissitudes of the human heart. Now they both had to follow their own paths. Thorn touched her hand gently, the gesture hidden in the shadows that hung between them. "No," he said, "we're not taking them back to Resurgam. But can we honestly say we're taking them to a better place? What if all we're doing is taking them to a different place to die?" "It's a starship, Thorn." "Yes. One which isn't going anywhere in a hurry." "Yet," she said. "I sincerely hope you're right." "Ilya made progress with the captain," she said. "He began to come out of his shell. If she managed to persuade him to deploy the cash weapons, she can talk him into moving." He turned from the porthole, harsh shadows emphasizing his face. "And then? Another system. It doesn't matter which one. We'll take our pick. Anything's got to be better than staying here, hasn't it?" "For a while, perhaps. But shouldn't we at least investigate what Sylvestre can do for us?" She took her hand from his and said guardedly, "Sylvestre? Are you serious?" "He took an interest in our affairs inside Rock. At the very least, something did. You recognized it as Sylvestre or a copy of his personality.
and the object, whatever it was, returned to Hades.
What are you suggesting?
That we consider the unthinkable, Anna, seeking his help. You told me that the Hades matrix is older than the inhibitors. It may be something stronger than them. That certainly appeared the case inside Rock. Shouldn't we see what Sylvester has to say on the matter? He might not be able to help us directly, but he might have information we can use. He's been in there for subjective eons, and he's had access to the archive of an entire starfaring culture.
You don't understand, Thorne. I thought I told you, but obviously it didn't sink in. There's no easy way into the Hades Matrix.
No, I remember that. But there is a way, even if it involves dying, isn't there?
There was another way, but there's no guarantee it still works. Dying is the only way I know, and I'm not going there again, not in this life or the next.
Thorne looked down, his face a mask that she found difficult to read. Was he disappointed or understanding? He had no idea what it had been like to fall towards Hades knowing that certain death awaited her. She had been resurrected once, after meeting Sylvester and Pascal, but there had been no promises that they would repeat the favor. The act itself had consumed a considerable fraction of the computational resources of the Hades object, and they, whoever were the agents that directed its endless calculations, might not sanction the same thing again. It was easy for Thorne. He had no idea what it had been like.
"Thorne," she began.
But at that moment, pink and blue light stammered across the side of his face.
Curry frowned. "What was that?"
Thorne turned back towards space.
"Lights. Flashing lights, like distant lightning. I've been watching them every time I walk past a porthole.
They seem to lie near to the ecliptic plane, in the same half of the sky as the inhibitor machine. They weren't there when we left orbit. Whatever it is must have started in the last 12 hours. I don't think it's anything to do with the weapon itself."
"Then it must be our weapons," Curry said. "Ilya must have started using them already. She said she'd give us a period of grace."
It was true. Ilya Volyova had promised them that she would not deploy any of the cash weapons for 30 days, and that she would review her decision based on the success of the evacuation operation.
"Something must have happened," Curry said.
"Or she lied,"
Thorne said quietly. In the shadows, he took her hand again, and with one finger traced a line from her wrist to the conjunction of her middle and forefingers.
"No, she wouldn't have lied. Something's happened, Thorne. There's been a change of plan."
It came out of the darkness, 2 hours later. There was nothing that could be done to prevent some of the occupants of the transfer craft from seeing Nostalgia for Infinity from the outside, so all Curry and Thorne could do was wait and hope that the reaction was not too extreme. Curry had wanted to slide baffles across the portholes. The ship was of too old a design for the portholes to be simply sphinctered out of existence, but Thorne had warned her that she could do nothing that implied that the view was in any way odd or troublesome. He whispered, "It may not be as bad as you expect. You know what a lighthugger's meant to look like, and so the ship disturbs you because the captain's transformations have turned it into something monstrous. But most of the people we're carrying were born on Resurgam. Most of them haven't ever seen a starship, or even any images of what one should look like. They have a very vague idea based on the old records, and the space operas they've been fed by Broadcasting House. Nostalgia for Infinity may strike them as a bit unusual, but they won't necessarily jump to the conclusion that she's a plague ship."
"And when they get aboard?" Curry asked.
"Now that might be a different story."
Thorne, however, turned out to be more or less correct. The shocking excrescences and architectural flourishes of the ship's mutated exterior looked pathological to Curry, but she knew more about the plague than anyone on Resurgam. It turned out that relatively few of the passengers were as disturbed as she had expected. Most were prepared to accept that the flourishes of diseased design served some obscure military function. This, after all, was the ship that they believed had wiped out an entire surface colony. They had few preconceptions about what it should look like, other than that it was, by its very nature, evil.
"They're relieved that there's a ship here at all," Thorne told her, "and most of them can't get anywhere near a porthole anyway. They're taking what they're hearing with a large pinch of salt,
or they just don't care. How can they not care when they've thrown away their lives to come this far?
They're tired, Thorn told her, tired and past caring about anything except getting off this ship.
The transfer craft executed a slow pass down the side of Infinity's hull. Curry had seen the approach enough times to view the prospect with only mild interest, but now something made her frown again.
That wasn't there before, she said.
What?
She kept her voice low and refrained from pointing. That scar. Do you see it?
That thing. I can't miss it.
The scar was a meandering gash that wandered along the hull for several hundred meters. It appeared to be deep, very deep, in fact, gouging far into the ship. And it had every sign of being recent. The edges were sharp, and there were no traces of any attempts at repair. Something squirmed in Curry's stomach.
It's new, she said.